Hello and welcome to So You Think You Can Fanon. Please check the link tree in the description and see all of our beautiful, lovely, salacious links to listen to more. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to So You Think You Can Fanon. I'm your host Sergio, and today I'm just here with Matt for another How We Fanon.
Yep, specifically us, Sergio and I, the greatest, the gods of all things.
The creator of the How We Fanon series. It's been quite a long time since we've done a How We Fanon. I don't even remember when the last one. I think it was the What If Tuco Could Do a Kamehameha that we did.
I forgot about that.
Oh, well, there was the romance tropes one.
I think that was the last one we did, maybe.
But that was like last Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
So it's been about a year.
It's good to be back with this. I like this format a lot, actually. I think we need to do a lot more of them. It's an underrated format on the podcast.
And this was our one where we'll be primarily talking about video games, because we've mostly just been talking about writing in general, as it applies to all media. But this episode, we're going to finally talk about some video games, because I've been looking to discuss some recent video games that I've been playing. Yes.
And of course, we must talk imminently about the stories of video games. But video games have a very interesting problem to overcome, in that you're not just watching things happen in front of you. You actually are a part of the way the game plays out in some way, shape, or form. And there are moments where that does not connect with traditional storytelling. What do we call that, Sergio? What do we call that phenomena?
That is called ludonarrative dissonance.
Yes.
Which is a term that gets thrown around a lot. I feel at this point it's gotten a little overused. And at this point it's to determine, because like for example, people will be like, oh, well, in 358 days, I was using the Omega weapon, but in the cutscene, I was using the Kingdom Key. Ludonarrative dissonance. That's not what this term, like, to me, should mean.
That's too small of an example. Staying in 358 days. Go ahead.
But yeah, because obviously there's the, you know, there's always the gameplay cutscene differences. The game has pre-rendered cutscenes, so you have to use the stock weapon in all of the battles. This happens a lot in Mass Effect. 358 Days is another example. You know, it's on the DS. Not all the cutscenes were rendered in-engine. But the original meaning of the term, and the term that we will use today, is when specifically the themes of the gameplay clash with the themes of the story.
And oh my god, can there be some games where there's some clashing? But, you know, there's also a few games that really use them to their advantage. I think we've done a decent job of explaining ludonarration and what it is, so why don't we go ahead and start talking about the games that really fuck it up? And why not start with the poster child that actually led to a games journalist coining the term ludonarrative dissonance in the first place, BioShock.
Yeah, so it was a guy named Clint Hawking. He was a he started out at LucasArts, and he moved over to Ubisoft. He worked on the Splinter Cell games, Far Cry 2, Watch Dogs Legion. He's working on some Assassin's Creed projects now.
Interesting.
But he wrote an article about BioShock, where in BioShock, you know, you have the mechanic of the little sisters, and you have the option to either save them by, you know, undoing their curse or whatever, and getting a modest amount of Adam from them. Is it Adam or is it Eve? I don't remember.
I don't remember either. I have never actually played BioShock.
Okay. Or you can kill them and gain a larger amount of the resource. Now, from a purely gameplay perspective, and the fact that your own morality isn't getting in the way of you murdering a digital 10-year-old girl, the gameplay, like, is wanting you to kill them. You know, more resources, more powerful character, better, you know, better at combat. But the story has your character basically being selfless. So the gameplay is promoting this theme of purely self-interest, while the narrative is having you be selfless. And this causes a clash in themes, and the game does punish you by giving you the bad ending for killing a majority of the little sisters. But for a majority of the game's runtime, there's no downside to killing the little sisters.
Yeah, there's something to be said for how gaining more power from killing little sisters is also narratively the easier way out for him. But, like, the story cannot adapt to that. And I shouldn't say cannot, it does not adapt to that at all. You can play the game like a fucking psychopathic, murdering, child genociding killer after you've saved, like, one girl, and I think you still get the normal ending, right?
It's been a while
since I've heard about the exact details.
Yeah, I
have to save all of them to get like a normal ending.
Yeah, it says if you harvest more than one, you get the bad ending.
Oh, interesting. Never mind then. Interesting. But I think the other parts of the little narrative dissonance also come from the fact that your character, like, just wears a sweater, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
I mean, yeah, he's just in, like, regular clothes.
He's just a dude. And he's dealing with insane, psychotic monsters and shit down in this place. And the story for Bioshock, I've heard, is very good. I don't think this makes the story, like, bad by any means. But it's very interesting that it has some of these gameplay-to-story conflicts, which is not... Go ahead.
I don't think ludonarrative dissonance is necessarily a terrible thing. I think it can... I think primarily it can take you out of, you know, with the immersion. It's a bit of an immersion-breaking thing, but I don't really think that it really ruins the narrative of...
Yeah. It's very immersion-related, more than just the story. Like, the story could be great and amazing entirely on its own, but ludonarrative dissonance means the story and the gameplay are just, they're not intertwined. They are not...
Yeah, they're at odds with each other.
Yeah, they're at odds with each other, and the more you enjoy one, you might start to dislike the other in some capacities. That's not necessarily true, but ideally they should be in harmony with one another. Some other games where I think it's pretty obvious the harmony is disrupted is Mass Effect.
I put both Mass Effect and Dragon Age down on here. I think it's worse in Mass Effect than it really is in Dragon Age. But, because obviously BioWare, two same companies. But specifically in Mass Effect, you know, you're given the Paragon and the Renegade system, and you're explained that Renegade options are the morally incorrect options, and the Paragon are actions that are considered morally just. And this does not necessarily mean that every Paragon choice is overall the better choice. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the Renegade option is the better choice, even though it sounds morally incorrect. Like, for example, there's a part in Mass Effect 2 on Garrus's mission, where you're talking to, because, you know, you've infiltrated the mercenaries that are going after Garrus, and you're trying to reach him before they do. And you find the mechanic who's working on their gunship, and you're given a potential Renegade interrupt to stab a tool into the guy's neck and electrocute him to death before he can finish the gunship. It's right. More beneficial to you to kill that guy, but it's not necessarily the morally right thing to stab a guy in the back, especially because this guy was, I think, just their engineer. I don't think he actually pilots the gunship or shows up in the combat. But we would argue that the more beneficial thing to the scope of the story and to the scope of your goals is to kill that guy. But despite this being true, Shepard never faces the consequences of his actions. If you play a 100% Renegade Shepard and do a bunch of morally horrendous things, you almost never are reprimanded for it. The one time Shepard is stripped of his rank and punished is for a non-story action This happens even if you don't complete the Arrival DLC in Mass Effect 2. You're still grounded by the Council and the Systems Alliance. And the few times that you are criticized, like, for example, if you sabotage the Genophage cure in Mass Effect 3, when Rex comes to kill you, you easily dispatch Rex, and everyone goes, damn, so sad about Rex.
Well,
none of your companions go, what the fuck? No, nobody goes, Shepard, Rex has been our friend for 2 games. What the hell? Shepard can genocide the entire Quarian race and have Tali commit suicide, but Garrus, Liara, Kaden slash Ashley say nothing about this. To my knowledge, at least. I didn't do that because I'm not a psychopath. I can't confirm that they don't have comments about it, but like, you can't get Garrus to leave the party no matter what you do. He'll stand by you no matter how many shitty things you do. Kill Rex? Doesn't care. Kill Tali? Doesn't care.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. I would be surprised if they said nothing about it, but I don't know. I don't know. That'd be interesting if that was the case.
I mean, you can actually leave. You don't have to recruit Garrus in Mass Effect 1. And he'll bring it up in Mass Effect 2 that he was just left behind on the Citadel and didn't get to adventure with Shepard. But there's no way to get him to, you know, leave the party. And Dragon Age has this too, where, like, you know, you can commit terrible things that I think your squad members would definitely question or be opposed to, and outside of a few specific moments, won't leave the party.
Interesting.
Which I think Baldur's Gate actually handles really well with its things that would get the party members to leave.
Yes, for all of the funny stuff in Baldur's Gate that might be a bit ridiculous, the party members will just fucking leave the minute you start doing stuff that they don't think they would stick around somebody to do with.
Like choosing to massacre the druids and side with the goblins.
Yep, that instantly locks you out of a lot of party members. It's a pretty huge thing, which makes sense. A lot of the game is built around that being a big decision in the game, and it is a big decision.
In stark contrast to that, some of the BioWare, they did this really well in KOTOR 1 and 2. I should say Obsidian did it well in 2 and BioWare did it well in 1, where obviously most of your party, I think all of your party in, well, I would say most of your party in KOTOR 1 is, you know, a light sider or light side aligned, and they will chastise you if they're in the party, if you perform dark side actions, and your more dark sided companions will complain that you're being a little too nice. But the final choice that you make at the end of the game to either defeat Darth Malak, become a hero of the Republic, or to fall to the dark side and use the Star Fort to conquer the Republic, will force all of your light-sided party members to you have to kill them, essentially. There's no way around it.
Interesting.
But in 2, because 2 had the influence system, which each individual party member, where the influence system was like, you know, if you did things that were like that the party member approved of, you'd raise their influence and then you'd, you know, lower it. But if you had low influence with a party member, they would switch sides. So if you were a light sider and you had low influence with Atten, he would turn to the dark side. Or if you were dark side, he would turn to the light side. And especially near the end of the game, if you had party members with low influence that were like opposed to your
decisions and your
choices. Yeah, then there were special cutscenes for them.
I see. That is really good. That's the kind of stuff that keeps it good going. And I think that's a point where ludonarrative dissonance would ruin the story if they didn't have good connections like that. Because there are games like KOTOR where it's so much more story focused that the gameplay and the narrative really should connect together. In contrast to that, you know, this applies to all games. Stardew Valley is the kind of game where it's not serious, so it doesn't matter a whole lot if there's some weird, funny inconsistencies. But, you know, there's some funny gameplay inconsistencies when you think about it logically, where you can go into the mines and just cleave through hundreds of enemies and do anything that you could possibly need to down there. But the second that you have to till a few too many tiles or you have to water a few too many crops, you just drop past the fuck out on the ground. Can't do anything else for the rest of the day. This is really funny.
Oh. Yeah, I never played Stardew Valley and thought it was just a wholesome farming game. And then today Matt tells me that it has combat, which is not what I was
there's
expecting.
There's a lot of combat in it too, if you want to. You can play the game as almost entirely a dungeon delving combat game, funnily enough. Which is incredibly silly when you realize that there are people who don't realize that's part of the game. I don't think there's anything else I necessarily wanted to say about Stardew Valley, but I think that Stardew Valley is interesting in that what I bring up is more of a gameplay narrative inconsistency. There's not a whole lot of the character story elements that interact with that a whole lot, as little of there is actual story in Stardew Valley in the first place.
Well, next on the list is another trope that I see, which is, so you'll have some kind of substance that is described as being extremely dangerous or addictive, or maybe you just can't be exposed to it too much. However, in the gameplay, you can consume a ton of it without any negative repercussions. For example, in Dragon Age, red lyrium, for example, is said to control the minds of those who have it on them and have negative effects by those who stay around it too much. But you can go into the mines and touch and be around as much red lyrium as possible, and no one ever gets affected by it. Or, for example, you drink lyrium for your MP potions. Even though this is considered bad, it's addictive and slowly poisons you over time in the plot.
Interesting.
Or also in Dragon Age 1, they say, like, you know, you stay away from darkspawn blood, because if you get covered in too much of it, you'll slowly lose your mind and become a darkspawn. And despite this, your non-Grey Warden party members will, you know, just cleave through hordes of darkspawn and get covered in their blood and nothing ever happens to them.
That's funny. This subject reminds me, I've been doing a Fallout New Vegas playthrough recently because of the Fallout TV show. And in that game, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happens because of radiation. And if you get too irradiated for too long, you will turn into a monster. And funnily enough, you just go to any fucking doctor in the wasteland and they'll just instantly be able to cure you of all your radiation. Just instantly. No worries about it at all. It's not even an expensive procedure. You just hand them like 50 to 100 caps and then you're done. All of it's gone.
Where's the cancer ending to Fallout?
That'd be crazy if there was.
Did they fix cancer in the future?
Well, I mean, they must have. That must be the logic behind it. Maybe there's lore to it that I don't know. I just think it's really funny. Pokemon.
Yes, is an interesting Pokemon. One
that's also related to this.
Pokemon does this a lot, especially with the Pokédex entries. You know, Charizard's fire can melt boulders. They do half damage against rock types. But the primary thing is that in the Pokemon, there's a message of Pokemon are friends, not weapons. But let's be real here. You use Pokemon to fight things. That is the gist of the gameplay and part of the story. You know, you assault gang bases, you know, whenever you have to take out like a team base. What do you do that with? Your Pokemon. These gang members consistently accost you and attack you with their Pokemon. And in self-defense, you whip out
your Pokemon. Yep.
Another you go to thing. Catch some legendary Pokemon, and what do you do? Well, in order to weaken it, you have to whip out a Pokemon.
a Pokemon is actually God, Arceus. You've also got other Pokemon that control the land and the sea, control the harmony of the world, and other shit like that. It was like, eh, just stick them in a Pokeball. It's fine. Don't worry about it. And they're stuck with you. They can't get away. They're in the Pokeball. Oh my god. Pokemon, that reminds me of the fanfic we were covering, actually, where it's like scientific Pokemon. I think that one takes Pokemon a lot more seriously than the games do.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting thing to cover.
I wonder, because I obviously we haven't read through it all, but I wonder if they do cover, like, what would happen if you realistically caught a legendary Pokemon.
I think that would be interesting to talk about that, because these Pokemon have shit they've got to do, man. They need to be there available for the shit that they're going to go and do. To manage parts of the world and stuff. Anyways, what do we have next up on here? We have
characters
in cutscenes.
Yes, this is especially a problem in Yakuza 7 and Yakuza 8, where you will, of course, have characters in your party, but they just completely disappear during the cutscenes.
Yep. And the most famous example of this that I played recently is Borderlands 3, where it's not the party members that disappear in the cutscene, it's you! You disappear in almost every fucking cutscene that you watch in that game, because you can't do fucking shit in Borderlands 3. You're just stuck there watching as NPCs are killed in front of you, shit's happening, villains are grabbing things, and you're just standing there with, like, the world's most powerful insta-gib gun. Just can't do anything. Just can't do it. It's not possible.
Especially, like, in the context of Yakuza, Ryuga Gotoku Studios really does not want to show any female characters fighting. I was surprised a few times in Yakuza 8 that they actually showed, like, a few of the female characters, like, facing off in the cutscenes. Because especially in 8, like, when you're fighting, like, a storyline boss, everybody just vanishes like you know in Yakuza when, like, you deal enough damage and then there's, like, a little cutscene thing, and if you do the quick time event right, you deal some damage to the boss. They just disappear for those. Which to me is a little bit disappointing. I'd like to see, you know, my party members actually doing something in this teamwork focused game.
This in particular, I think, is where ludonarrative stuff gets to be a huge fucking pain in the ass. Because when you, in RPGs, you can have such powerful people, and they just don't influence the story in a way that works very well. And just for a second, Sergio, can you pause it? I need to help my mom with something, and I'll be right back in like 2 minutes.
Yep.
But yeah, RPG stuff with the story is where I think a lot of the bigger ludonarrative problems come from. Are there any other RPGs you can think of that cause that?
Where characters in your party disappear in cutscenes. Trying to think. I was literally on the TV Tropes page for that. I know Kingdom Hearts is pretty good at keeping Donald and Goofy in the cutscenes.
They are. Related to this, but I think this is just bad story writing, is when characters have guns and they don't use them in the cutscene.
That's what I like about Leon in RE4, because he just starts shooting people instead of just standing there.
Yeah, Leon
and letting them monologue
in RE4.
Well, I mean, like, RE4 remake is what I mean.
Even in the original, he does pretty good with it. Although the original does have some dumb shit, and I love some of the cheesy lines with it. But God, they're so silly to have Leon say, "No way, bro."
No way, bro.
I'm so sad they removed some of the cheesy dialogue in Remake. It's so sad. Back to actual ludonarrative stuff, though. What about when you're a grown-ass fucking adult and you just don't have any money? You should be able to afford anything that you need to.
Yes. So this is another Yakuza-related issue. Like in Yakuza 7... There's a part where the Seiryu clan chairman needs you to raise like a million yen or something, and the characters are like, ah, shit, how are we supposed to, you know, handle that? You know, oh man, that's going to be a while for us to scrape together that money. I'm pretty sure I had it in my inventory, or if not, I ran to Ichiban Confections and, you know, raised the money. Which is a big part of the dissonance between Yakuza's story and its side quests. But in Yakuza 7, Ichiban becomes like the multi-millionaire in yen. Well, I guess it would he would become a USD millionaire at some point. Owner of the Ichiban Confections candy shop empire. But in the cutscene, he's as broke as can be, and Yakuza 8 completely ignores that minigame. They don't even mention it. Like, oh, he lost the company.
I know, or that's something. Easily the craziest thing. There's a whole party member tied up in that, and she just never shows up anywhere. Despite
yeah, because she... I think she was a likeness character, so she was only really going to appear in one game.
Okay, that would make some sense. Kieran, by the way, God bless him, for that million yen, Sergio, you know what he did?
What did he do?
He grinded fucking encounters!
What? I don't even remember how much yen you get per encounter in that game, but it's always playing Yakuza 8.
It's nothing.
It's always playing Yakuza, going through the post game in Yakuza 8. I don't think you get like a tenth. It's definitely not 100, like 100,000 yen per encounter. It's maybe like 50,000.
Yeah, no, you get almost nothing. He did the Sotenbori Tower, like, twice to get the money, and it was really funny to hear him say that, because I was like, Kieran, did you not do the fucking money minigame? And he stopped for like 5 seconds and said, oh my god, I'm so stupid. But yeah, no, the amount of money that you can have, this is also an RPG related issue too, like, you can have so much money in these games that you would be just ask, why can't I just buy something outright? No, like, there's a problem of money in the story. No, I'll just buy it for you. It's nothing.
It happens in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, where the party is consistently broke and has to do something to get like a room at the inn. But like by the end of the game, I had 150,000 gil.
I know. It's so silly. There's another game I'm going to talk about at length for just a second here. Phantom Brave is the most chaotic fucking thing when it comes to this possible, because the story is good, and the fact that the characters have healing or combat abilities is represented very well in the cutscenes and stuff. The main girl, Morona, who is a orphaned sad girl who has healing abilities and can summon the dead to be confined to an item and help her, and you know, fun weird shit like that. She gets to do all that stuff in cutscenes, and it has importance to the story. But at the same time, one of the big parts of the story in the early game is that you need to be able to buy your island. You need the money to buy the island. And you know, you're a little girl, you don't have that much money, but you go back to the gameplay after you get the cutscene that lets you buy the island, and you've got like 500 million times the money that would have cost to buy the island just sitting in your inventory ready to go, because you've been grinding like a motherfucker at that point. And it's just so funny. You really have to suspend your disbelief with some things like that, unfortunately. But, you know, like I've said before, it doesn't necessarily get in the way of the story. It just kind of breaks your immersion. I think a more important one that's more story related that I think we might agree on is the Vikings.
Yes. So, if for people aren't familiar with the Assassin's Creed series, the whole thing in Assassin's Creed is that everybody carries the genetic memories of your ancestors. And if you can use, a device called the Animus to relive these memories. And the Animus has a bit of some rules surrounding it, in which you must remain in sync with the memories. You can't do things that would, you know, change history or go too far off the path. And one of these things that was introduced all the way from the first Assassin's Creed game was your ancestor did not kill civilians, and killing like three or more civilians intentionally, not through like you like they accidentally walked through your poison cloud bomb and got poisoned and died, would cause a desynchronization, which is, you know, cause for the game over train that game. Obviously, if your ancestor dies before he has given birth to you and the memory would end, then that would, you know, desync you from the animus.
Kind of a problem timeline.
Yeah, really. But this rule has never killed a civilian works for most of the protagonists of the Assassin's Creed games, as you can realistically believe that these, you know, righteous assassins who in their creed have a rule that they aren't to kill innocent people, wouldn't have intentionally killed a civilian. But then we get to Assassin's Creed Valhalla, where you play as Eivor, a member of a Nordic Viking clan, I believe, who sets up shop in UK, in the UK to find a new home for his people and start raiding the local Christian monasteries and such. And here's the thing. You go on your first raid. You know, you roll up to a monastery, your boys pop off the long boat, and you're ready to, you know, pillage and get some loot. You strike the nearest fleeing civilian. Warning. Eivor didn't kill civilians. What do you mean? Now, I think this could have been done with Eivor, because Eivor is a very thoughtful person. He writes poetry. He's very introspective. That perhaps that's not the way he goes about things. But the game never makes this clear to you. So I'm very confused in this game where I'm playing as a Viking that basically how the raids go down is all of the civilians run out and all of my guys just target the knights defending the monastery and we just make out with the gold.
That's it.
We commit armed robbery. No civilians died. Even though you set houses on fire during these raids, nobody perishes except for the guards no and the knights that were defending whatsoever. The monasteries.
No issues.
You don't target any of the priests for being heretics to your religion. I mean, Eivor himself doesn't have he doesn't have any biases towards the church or anything like that. But none of your other guys don't do that. Like, it just kind of took me out of it a little bit. Or here's another thing that took me out of it that's due to Ubisoft's shitty game design, which I could never figure out was a bug or Ubisoft decided to leave this in. But canonically, the protagonist of Assassin's Creed Valhalla is a woman. But I wanted to play as the man because I thought the man was a better voice actor. Halfway through my game, I'm misgendered. I am called she, and it immediately took me out. And I was like, you really wanted the female to be that much that you just like kept that bit in there? And I could never find if it was a glitch or not, or if it was fixed or whatever. But I was seeing a lot of people saying that logs and stuff like that would refer to Eivor as a she, even if you pick the male option, which is just sticky poo-poo Ubisoft game design at work.
Very cringe. That sucks. That's annoying. But so funny that there's a Viking who doesn't kill. What else does this Viking not do? Does this Viking not actually steal things that are important to civilians? What happens after you burn down the fucking village? Surely people died in the cold after you burned their homes down in the winter.
Probably, and stole all their loot. Nobody got executed.
No raping, no pillaging, no nothing like that. That actually winds up...
Okay, I can see, like, not having raping as a mechanic, that's fine. Okay, we don't have to go into...
I mean, it's kind of what they did more than anything else. A little weird not to notice that.
I'm trying to think if Valhalla perhaps goes into that. Well, no. Eivor specifically does stop somebody from doing that. He's not about that.
Okay. All right. That's fine.
I think it's in one of the like the CGI trailers that they put out. They do address that that's something that happens. Okay.
All right. I'll stand down. They did their due diligence.
But that's a little silly that I get penalized for accidentally striking a civilian. Because I'm sure that Eivor, you know, in his campaign to strike fear in the enemy, might have killed a few priests.
He absolutely definitely did.
He's not an assassin. He never took up the creed. He just thought a hidden blade was cool because he got it as a gift. And he is assassin, like adjacent. He's willing to assist the order, but he's not a member of the order. He does not subscribe to the no killing civilians rule.
Okay. All right. Now on to let's talk about some games that do a little bit of ludonarrative stuff really well, and then let's go on to our next topic. I think Dead Space is the really obvious choice for great ludonarrative coherence,
yes.
We'll call it.
Our protagonist, Isaac Clarke, is an engineer who gets stuck on the ISG Ishimura with, you know, the Necromorph outbreak. And immediately after finding a graffiti that says cut off their limbs because gamers are stupid and had to be told repeatedly to cut off the Necromorph's limbs because they weren't doing that. You know, that's, you know, part of the gameplay. He retrofits a plasma cutter that he finds next to it to fire plasma bolts to better dismember the Necromorphs, as well as turning his mining and engineering tools that he used on his job into effective killing weapons. Which is excellent narrative and story design, because a lot of games will have our protagonist picking up weapons that they would have no idea how to use properly and using them like a pro.
Yep. Shout out to the part where Lara Croft screams once about killing a guy in one of the first remake games and then just never again worries about it, despite the fact that she kills like thousands of people.
She also somehow learned how to fix old World War II weapons and turn them into their modern equivalents. I don't think anybody ever mentions that. She turns like an STG-44 into like an AK-47.
Nah, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. She's just good at it. She has a woman power.
You can also talk about how her character resets like every game and she has to become a killing machine all over again. And in the second game, she doesn't believe in the supernatural anymore.
What?
Yeah, in the second game's Baba Yaga DLC, she dismisses Baba Yaga as being magical. She's like, magic doesn't exist.
Bruh.
And of course, they make it so the Baba Yaga in the DLC isn't actually magical. She's just using hallucinatory gases to make you see that. But
of course,
I was like,
hallucinations. That's silly. That's very silly.
But then in the third one, she deals with some supernatural stuff again. So, you know, there's that.
That's silly. Let's see, some other games that do ludonarrative storytelling very well. What else can we think of?
Dishonored.
Sure, Dishonored is a pretty good one.
Yes, you do face the consequences for committing, you know, you have the low chaos and the high chaos system, where if you are taking the stealthy, non-lethal route, the world is better off for it. But if you're taking the lethal route and killing everything that comes in your path, then the world is worse off for it.
Yep, shit gets real fucked in that game.
Because Dishonored, I feel, tackles the problem that I feel like a lot of media doesn't, where a lot of media goes like, oh, if you just kill this person, it fixes the problem. 100%. But a lot of the low chaos options in Dishonored goes, look, you can't just kill the mob boss. You'll create a power vacuum. more people will die because of your actions. You need to replace him with someone who's better and will continue on with, you know, making the organization less terrible.
Yes. Yes, I remember some of that from when I did my playthrough of Dishonored, which is a very interesting system. It's got a definitively better ending that is harder to get, but I think is more fun to have to go through more of the hoops to do more gameplay and get through more places. I liked that a lot in that game. I thought that was a good thing. That was a good set of decisions that they did with that. And what else do we think you should talk about? I guess the obvious one, Spec Ops: The Line, is an insane video game.
Yes. The game that, you know, has you famously dumping white phosphorus all over civilians. Because I think at the time you thought they were the enemy, right? Didn't realize that they were civilians when you did that. I believe
that is the case. Yeah. Yes.
Yes, and then you're, of course, confronted with the horrors of your actions. Spec Ops: The Line is just an amazing video game about the horrors of war. And it's also actually inspired by Heart of Darkness, the book that Apocalypse Now is based off of.
Yes. And what else happens in the game? I can't remember. We should have had Kieran on here. I don't know what else to say about it. I guess one thing I'll mention that's not remotely related to our conversation here is that there's fucking, you can't get it on Steam anymore. I don't know where you can buy it anymore. Spec Ops is just gone, I think.
They took it off?
Yep, it's not on Steam anymore. I don't know why. Forgot why. I think it...
Yeah, it was delisted January of this year.
Damn. That sucks. Oh, Metal Gear Solid 2. That's a game that I think actually has some pretty good ludonarrative coherence. There's lots of weird, crazy shit that happens at the end of the game that really makes you question what's real and what isn't. And it seriously puts you into the headspace of the main character, Raiden. You really wonder what the hell is going on from his perspective.
Is that the one where, like... Which Metal Gear game has, like, the swamp that's got everybody you killed in the game?
That's Metal Gear Solid 3. Yeah, let's just say all the Metal Gear Solid games do a good job of this. There's lots of crazy shit in all of them that combines the story and the gameplay in a very literal way. Although sometimes it gets a bit ridiculous that your suspension of disbelief doesn't really work anymore. I could see you argue. I could see people arguing one way or the other about a lot of those games, honestly. But overall, I think it's fair to say that ludonarrative dissonance is something I personally care more about than most people. I don't know how you feel about it, Sergio. What do you think about it?
I don't necessarily think it's a huge problem. I definitely think it is something to take care to not do too much of. Because I feel like it definitely in some cases can break immersion and divorce people from the story that you're trying to tell. You can use it well to make your character a hypocrite, to critique them in that sense. I remember playing Saints Row 4. Here's me about to say that there is something deep in Saints Row 4, the game with the Murica gun. But for the majority of Saints Row 4, everyone's constantly calling you a sociopath, and the villain is criticizing you as such. Now, Saints Row 4 came out in 2013. So you got little 13-year-old me playing this video game, and I'm like, wow, I don't know what that means. I don't think I'm a sociopath. My character's a sane individual. But then there's a part where the villain starts breaking it down, and because he's like, you drive on the sidewalk because it's faster, hitting all those. He starts going through things that you do in the gameplay. He's talking about you, the player, which again is you, the character. Mm-hmm. Everybody plays GTA type Saints Row games, you know, like sociopaths.
Yeah, like a fucking insane person.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, that's actually pretty smart that they actually put that into the lore, that the main character does do this. He does treat the world like his own little playground. And, you know, mercilessly kills dozens of people without, like, a, you know, a blink of an eye.
Yeah, no, GTA is insane in this sense. The stories in GTA in general have always fascinated me with how fucking crazy they get. And, oh my god, they're so funny. Especially some of the ones from back in the day, too. I was watching some San Andreas cutscenes on YouTube, and I can't remember who it is, but there's some guy who's just, like, doing crack in a room with some weird assholes. I don't know. I'd have to go watch it to talk about it on the podcast again, but goddamn, all those games are so fucking funny at their peaks. It's some of the finest comedy ever with how insanely awful so many of the people are. And it's everybody knows they're horrible. Everybody knows they're the worst, and it's great. But I think that's enough narrative discussion for now. Let's talk about the thing that you wanted to talk about for this episode, Sergio. Exploration. Yes.
So this has been an ongoing issue in modern AAA gaming, I feel, especially with the advent of the open world game, where games appear to be doing a lot more hand-holding, a lot more objective markers, a lot more hints and tips and characters calling things out to you and stuff like that. You know, God of War Ragnarok famously has a... I want to say his name is Boy. I know his name is a boy. Atreus.
Atreus.
Will, you know, if you spend more than a minute on the puzzle, he'll call out the solution to the story-based ones. The optional ones, they let you figure those out. Or, like, you know, he'll call out when an attack is coming. Or when you've been affected by a status effect. Even though there is a status effect marker and a hit marker to let you know that you have an incoming damage, like, you know, an incoming attack coming towards you, and also just the visual thing of being on fire or being covered in Bifrost, the game decides to let you know vocally that you're on fire. Should get a little annoying. But the one thing that I want to talk about specifically is how games now, especially one game in particular, seems to be discouraging player exploration. That game is Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. To describe, because you've never played Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, how the side content is structured. Okay, so this little fuck named Chadley, I'll send you a picture of Chadley. Fuck. In general. So this is Chadley. He was introduced in the first remake, part one. He's like this little Shinra android boy, and his whole deal was, like, he ran a combat simulator and he made, like, materia. So you would go to the combat simulator, you'd, like, fight, like, some summons, you'd get the summon materia from him. Occasionally he would have, like, special materia types for you to buy if you complete challenges. All right, good, you know, piece of side content, side quest giver in the first game, no problems whatsoever. The second game, they decide to expand his role. Chadley walks up to you and he's like, Cloud, you have to activate my towers. So you know the standard, you know, synchronization Assassin's Creed towers that open up the map.
The open world and, towers. Yep.
You go to Chadley's towers and they, you know, it opens up all of the side content in the area for you to do. But here's the thing. All of the side content in each of the areas is through this, like, tower system that Chadley has set up. There's no incentive for you to find things, because you could not pick up any of these towers and you could stumble onto the, like, the, because there is, like, optional fiend fights. There's, like, caches of treasure and stuff like that. But it's basically set up in a way where you're handheld to every location. You scan enough life springs and Chadley goes, oh, Cloud, if you go to this area, you can dig up some new recipes to make new items. The game isn't rewarding you for going, oh, you explored this area and you found some buried treasure. No, Chadley will just tell you where this is once you've scanned enough life springs. Or each individual area has a like a regional boss, but you don't stumble into this regional boss. Oh no, once you collect all those life springs that I tell you, Chadley goes, Cloud, there's a monster in this area. Go take it out. And then you walk into that area and you have to, you know, then you engage with it. And I just think this is boring, first off. Two, it makes me interact with this little fucker more than I want to. He's annoying, and he made like a female version of himself, which is even more annoying.
What?
Which I think is supposed to be a bit of a like it's a joke that Chadley made a version of himself that he finds annoying. But no, there's a female version of him that will not shut the fuck up when you're doing the optional monster fights. And you can't turn her dialogue off either when you're doing these optional monster fights. And then it gets even worse, because each area has a side quest chain to get a thing called a proto-relic. And once you collect all the proto-relics in all of the areas you unlock a new optional dungeon. But what will happen is you'll do one proto-relic and be like, all right, Cloud, we have to find the next Fort Condor game board. It says here that it might be located in this mountain area. And then, you know, you as the player thinking, oh, I know where that is. I'll go look. And then Chadley will pop up and go, Cloud, I've located the next proto-relic. There you go.
You're fucking kidding me. So he just immediately removes all your ability to do anything in terms of exploration. He just tells you.
Yeah, or... There's an optional card playing mini game called Queen. It's a card game that has like a whole storyline involved with it. Queen's Blood. And I really enjoyed it. And I remember I was going through a town and I saw a Queen's Blood player that was a higher rank than me. And I made a mental note, like, all right, this guy's in the Corral town. And when I get to a higher rank, when I get to a high enough rank, I'll come back and challenge him. When I hit that rank, I get a call from Chadley, despite him not being a part of the side quest chain, to not only let me know that I have ranked up, but there's a guy for me to fight. And then the guy that I made a mental note of got marked on the map. And because of this, there's nothing, like, there are no, like, outside of, like I mentioned, like the, you know, the buried treasure spots that, you know, Chadley will let you know of once you've collected enough life springs. There's not really any like items or treasure on the world map. I know, like, in the original game, because, like, you know, in the original game, like, you had the flat overworld, then you'd step onto a city and go into it. There wasn't really anything like treasure wise to find on that. And obviously in, you know, a modern time, that has been converted into these like big open zones. But in FF7 Rebirth, there's just not a lot of, like, things to miss or things to find. I mean, like, dungeons and stuff still have treasure chests and materia to find. But, like I mentioned to you before the recording, if you miss a weapon in Rebirth, you just get it in the next shop. And it's stupid because in the first remake part, if you missed a weapon... Well, that was it. There's chapter select after you beat the game, so you could go back to the, you know, the chapter select and pick it up. And I like that, because that's how, like, it was in the original, obviously. Even finding the summons, because, like, finding summons in the original Final Fantasy games used to be, like, you know, you'd have to do, like, a quest, or it was at the end of, like, a mini game. But you get to a new area, and Chadley's like, Cloud, I've got a new summon in my simulator. Fight him and you get it, which obviously I have to work to fight and beat the summon to get him as a part of my party. But I don't know. It doesn't feel like working for it anymore.
Yeah.
And especially because, like, another thing is, like, in the original game, you had to earn the limit breaks for all the characters. I think some of them were tied to levels. Some of them were tied to mini games and so on and so forth. In the first game, the first remake part, I believe everybody's level 2 limit breaks were in like combat challenges. So you had to beat the challenge in order to get the limit break. But in Rebirth, all the limit breaks are part of the new skill tree they added, which I think is fine, because obviously I still need to work up to getting them. I have to level my characters up. I have to do quests in the world to unlock the nodes to get the limit break. But it's not as satisfying as earning it rather than, you know, buying it with experience points.
Yeah. It really sucks that that happened. Do you think exploration has gradually gotten worse over time with games, or do you think it's gotten better, or do you think Final Fantasy is just a selective weird odyssey in video game history with that? Because that really sounds like it's more to try to explore and rebirth.
Because don't get me wrong, I find the side content fun and enjoyable, but I don't like that it took all of the my urgency as a player to go looking for things. Because it's just telling me where everything is. And I think this definitely has gotten worse, especially with open, you know, I mentioned open world games. I feel like these open world games that have side content is now checklisty. You know, you go to an area and there's, got to tick off all the boxes, got to get all the little things and side quests and, you know, armors and stuff like that. And I feel like this sort of checklisty open world game design is kind of taking out all the fun of exploring a big open world.
Yeah, I think big open world stuff has always been hit and miss. Go ahead.
Square Enix just did this right in FF16. Because FF16, with the hunts system, they would tell you the general area of where the monster was that you had to hunt down, but you had to actually go look for it. They didn't oh, there it is. No, you'd get the hunt and it was oh, it's in blank desert, and then you'd have to go searching for it. So I know they're capable of doing more exploratory game design. I was just kind of let down, especially because Chadley is so goddamn annoying, and I just don't want to have to deal with him.
Yeah, that really sucks. Do you think the game would be dramatically better without Chadley, or do you think there's other problems with the exploration that need to be fixed?
I think I would at least like things like the proto relics. I think having some of them be marked out would be fine, but I would like things with the Queen's Blood example, the proto relics example, to let me use the context clues to go find the next one.
Okay.
Especially when sometimes it's obvious, there's one where you're tracking this group of guys down, and they said where they were going, and I had an idea of where they were, and you know, right before I can teleport to where I think they are, Chadley tells me, you know, where I was thinking that it was. Let me use my brain a little bit.
Because I know that there are absolutely some games where the case is something is so overly vague, there's just no frickin' way you can possibly do it correctly. But, you know, it sounds like they ruined a perfectly good system that they had there with Chadley and having him be overly interruptive all the time. That stuff is so sad and annoying.
Especially because, as many people will complain about Ubisoft, their open world, I think that Assassin's Creed still gives you some level of freedom. Because, in Valhalla, because, you know, all of the Assassin's Creed games have the, you know, do a certain thing to unlock the super special armor. Well, in Valhalla, because in Valhalla's case, you have to find these ancient Roman assassin bureaus that you have to break into and take the armor from. I believe the game gives you the general idea, but you as the player need to figure, because they're hidden in the, you know, the circle. So you still need to figure out how you're supposed to get into it and traverse it. And I like that. Or in Odyssey, Odyssey and Valhalla, you would often have to investigate a lot and get pieces of information to unlock information about your next target and where they would be on the map. Which, you know, gives some more player agency, other than, you know, obviously the little, you know, things that would pop up on the map from the synchronization points.
Interesting. I think a game that you might really like, Sergio, if you want a game that encourages exploration and running around and you like JRPG plots, you have to fucking play Ast Libra. Oh my god, it's so good. And I it's one of the only JRPGs I have ever played that I've actually wanted to 100%. And I basically 100% of the game. I don't think I went and did like the ultra tedious stuff, but like, holy crap. It's spelled A-S-T-L-I-B-R-A, Astlibra, and it is so damn good. It's so cool. It is the quintessential modern recreation of retro JRPG bullshit from every era. It's so fun, and there's so much stuff to do in it, and a lot of it is exploration based because it takes a lot of cues from Metroidvania games.
Yeah, I just I remember you talking about this.
Yeah, it's a good game. I will show for it every chance I get. I found it completely out of the blue one day after it had released, and oh my god, it consumed me for the time I was playing it. I rolled like 70 hours into it in the span of like a month, and it was crazy. It's fun. It's really, really fun. It's one of the few games that's really gripped me recently. And I think it's definitely going to be, I think it exemplifies a lot of things that good exploration should have. There's powerful, meaningful abilities and items and gear and content on the side when you want to go exploring for it. But you don't necessarily have to scour every single nook and cranny in order to have any fun with it or find anything. I think it's worth discussing what you think a good middle point on exploration is, especially for open world games. Do you think people should explore more than the current paradigm is in open world games, or do you think it's just the nature of exploration
that is annoying? There should always be something on the map that's unmarked, something that you learn about through NPC dialogue or like notes that you find in the world that lets you find something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like what, while like obviously like, you know, adding the quality of life thing of like, you know, markers and mission of like, oh, thank God. Like, so in some of those older RPGs, I'm like, I miss the main objective marker because it's like, I have no idea where to go. Yeah. Cause like, I don't mind the, you know, the synchronization towers and that unlocking all of the markers on the map or whatever. But I think there needs to be some sort of player agency because it's an open world. It's meant for you to explore. And I did like traversing the FF7 Rebirth map and finding these new areas, but I was doing that because I was following an objective marker and wasn't really exploring of my own volition.
Interesting. Maybe we'll spare a short discussion on do you think open games should become what everybody loves and plays and continues with, or do you think linear style games are still pretty damn good?
I think they're still pretty good. I mean, I can use the previous Final Fantasy VII remake as a perfect example of a linear game that still feels open and a curated experience that has some level of exploration and things for you to find and do.
It's just that they kind of stumbled on the more open exploration elements of it, made it sort of distasteful.
Yeah, like obviously do it. Obviously they had to, you know, bust open the open world because obviously we're getting into the meat of the original Final Fantasy VII, and they had to, you know, open it up, but I just think that they took a few of the wrong cues from modern game design for their open world.
Went a little bit too far in the wrong direction for some stuff. I think one thing I've noticed is over the last 7 years in gaming, there was a huge push about 12 years ago to go more open, which is where you get your Assassin's Creeds and you get your God of Wars, you get your other open world style games. And it does not necessarily have to be open to feel like you have a big grand adventure. And I think that's something a lot of people don't understand on the basic level. You do not have to have an open world game to feel like there is a world in your game in a lot of ways. It doesn't have to be the fucking Oblivion, Skyrim, Fallout experience in order to have places to go and to have things to do. There's a lot of things to be said for the more linear experiences. There doesn't even have to be an open level selector or a destination picker. Something like, I remember back in the day I played the Red Guerrilla games, and there was a very interesting problem that a lot of people had with the third game, which was a much more linear game than the second one had been. And I think I'm saying that right. Red Faction, Red Guerrilla,
it was Red Faction Guerrilla.
Red Faction Guerrilla. That's what I was thinking of. Yes. So the one that was... So Red Faction Guerrilla was the open world game where you could run around freeing little bits of settlements and demolishing stuff. And that game was really fun. But then Red Faction Armageddon was the sequel to it, which was much more linear. And, well, I think the story was kind of goofy. The gameplay in that was fucking awesome. You could do so much cool shit with the guns in it. Did you ever play it?
I never played the Red Faction games.
They're good. They are good games. I think that you should consider playing them at some point. But I found it funny that a lot of the community did not like Armageddon at all, because I thought the linear style level design of Armageddon was actually very refreshing. It had a lot of good objectives to go through, and while a lot of it was generic, it was still fun. It kept the pace going. Whereas in an open world game, you have to have the player be prepared for moments of brevity where the player is just traversing the world. The player is just going from one place to the next. And you know what? Hell, let's talk a bit about one of the big new games that came out recently and is getting a sequel. Why don't we talk about Death Stranding? Talk about a game that literally is about traversal and exploration and the openness of it. You played that, right? I'm pretty sure you did with Jake.
I watched Jake play like a few hours of it.
I've not
beaten it before.
Okay. What did you think of it as that you were watching it and seeing the early?
I definitely thought it was interesting. I don't think I really watched enough of it to really get a feel for it.
Do you subscribe to the Strand type game genrefication?
I don't know if I have any strong feelings for it. I definitely think it's fun. I like kind of chiller type games like that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very atmospheric, but I think it has a lot of stuff that a lot of other open world games, I think, don't have in some capacity, which is the meaningful elements of exploration. I think that's part of the nature of the design of the game, though, because just going from one place to the next is the gameplay. Whereas in a lot of other games, there's other stuff that you're moving to do along with the exploration. And I think maybe the developers of Rebirth for 7 mistakenly concluded that the process of finding and remembering and combining your knowledge of the world with where you need to go next is a positive part of the experience. It's not just a quality of life thing to remove that. And I think it changes the paradigm of the entire experience. I think is that fair to say that's sort of what you were thinking about with all of it?
Yeah, I would say so. Because also, would you consider using the same as Yakuza 7 and 8 to be open world RPGs now?
I think there's a little bit of open worldness to it. I think they're very small worlds.
Yeah, but there's definitely I feel like there's a lot of exploration still. There's still stuff to find.
Definitely in the sense of exploration, I think there's 100% a lot of that in the games, especially with the safes, at least in 7. I don't know if the safes come back in 8.
They're back, yeah.
Okay. Those definitely add a lot of benefits to the exploration, because you will get some good shit in those early on, and it can kind of change how you play the early game, honestly, if you get a lot of good stuff out of them. I think,
yeah, and they have it now in 8, where occasionally on the map you'll find some what do you call it, like powerful enemies guarding them in the open world.
Okay, yeah, that's good. I like that. I think that's actually very, very much a great example of good exploration. I think good exploration requires that what you are doing to traverse the world is not only fun unto itself, but what you acquire at the end of your exploration should also be meaningfully beneficial and powerful. A lot, like I said, like I think I mentioned earlier, Metroidvanias just fucking kill it on this front. Maybe I didn't actually mention it yet. Metroidvanias just blow everything else out of the water in this, because they're all about going around the world using fun traversal elements and then gathering up new upgrades, new powers, new abilities, and reusing those in the same gameplay loop, going back and finding shit and having fun, literally just moving from point A to point B. That's, I think, where the real meat and potatoes of exploration can come in from. Which reminds me of the obligatory repeating of the story of you somehow being such a god gamer, you made it almost all the way through Ori and the Blind Forest without the fucking heal ability.
Yeah, no, that was insane. I don't know how I pulled that off.
I don't know how you did that. That was fucking crazy. But I think you, have you played a lot of Metroidvanias? I forget.
Not really. I think the Ori games were the only ones that I've done to completion.
Interesting. How do you feel about maps along with exploration? Do you think they should immediately start marking things out as that you come close to them so you can remind yourself about it? Or do you think that there should be more, you have to go from one place to the next? I know on the topic of Metroidvanias, there is a certain someone we both know who really, really, really likes it when every single part of the map is pointed out and the next objective is immediately pointed to and things like that.
Well, do you mean like you get to like an area you can't get through and then on the map it's like marked with like an X so you know to like come back to it?
Yeah, like how, say you might get close to an area in a game where, and you see an upgrade there, like mm-hmm. like in Samus Returns, the remake of Metroid 2, it shows you actually on the map that there is an upgrade there that you should come back and get later. And just recently in a 3D platformer Metroidvania that I think is actually really good, called Pseudo Regalia, they just added a map to it, and it actually shows you where there are things that you have missed on the map if you actually went through an area and did not grab something from it, I believe. Because personally, I'm partial to those a little bit. What do you think?
I don't necessarily think that you need to have your handheld to know where to go. I especially think in those parts of game, those types of games, I'm like, well, where haven't I gone? You know, I don't mind having to work for something. I think in some games, it's a little like, God, I feel like I need a guide to figure out where, like, what I'm supposed to do.
I know exactly what you mean, where it's just like, it's so nebulous and so cryptic where you're supposed to go next.
Like, I remember I was playing Final Fantasy IV on the SNES, my grandma's house. It released as Final Fantasy II in America, but it was Final Fantasy IV. And I was doing pretty well until I got to this point where I had to find a black chocobo to fly to the island that had the next dungeon on it. And I could not for the life of me figure, I don't think I even knew I needed to find a chocobo for this. And like, I was stuck. I didn't have internet access, so I had no idea what to do, and I don't think I beat it till months later when I decided to go back to it, because I was just annoyed that like I couldn't figure out where I was supposed to go. Maybe there was an NPC or something that would let me know, but I couldn't find any. So yeah, that can be a bit annoying. I don't think that would happen in a modern game context. That'd probably be pointed out. But I do think some level of, you know, figuring out for yourself is fine.
I think that's fair. I don't think I have a whole lot else to say about exploration. Is there anything that you want to talk about?
There is just one thing here. I had it marked down on the on our little document here about healers in video games, and one particularly funny instance that I found in Star Ocean, Second Story R, where so you know usually in games the healer character is usually it's usually like a girly girl, someone who's very fragile and, you know, woo-woo. But in combat, these characters are usually pretty powerful, especially if they're the mage type of healer that can, you know, nuke enemies with fireballs and lightning. But in the cutscenes, they're like, ah, no, don't hurt me. and in Second Story R, our healer protagonist, Reyna, I think her name is, you know, she's a 16-year-old girl, healer. Guess what weapon she goes out with to defend herself against the fauna and the creatures that inhabit her planet?
Is it the Negev from Counter-Strike?
No. Think the medieval RPG. I know I mentioned planet, we're in the future, but think like medieval weapons.
No, I know that. That's just really hoped it would somehow be the Negev from Counter-Strike.
No, she doesn't have a GAT. This isn't the I'm a healer button.
Damn. All right, I'm out of guesses then. My heart's crushed.
Brass knuckles. She throws hands. And for the first like hour of the game, when you go through the initial forest, you beat a bunch of monsters to death. But the second you get back, and the local lord who's been afflicted by some like crystal that's making him evil, you know, sends his knights to capture her. And instead of beating the fuck out of these dudes, she's just like, just throws her hands up and goes, ah, no, get your hands off me. And I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. I know she's like 17 and these are a bunch of burly dudes and knights, but like,
that's fucking crazy.
Fight back?
Jesus. She's got brass knuckles to beat people.
It even happens with like Aerith in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, where she's like a capable fighter who's got like a big staff, and like you see her like always gearing up to fight people in the story. But there's so many times where it's like, ah, they got the better of me, or like, no, don't take, like, Aerith, hit them with your stick. Like, what?
Tisk tisk.
You have a 6-foot weapon and you let somebody get a grappling range of you?
That's just sad. That's just sad. Well.
Yeah, but I find these things more funny because that's my whole thing with Ludo Narrow Distance. It's a little wacky, it's a little funny, but I don't think it's as big of a deal as it's made out to be. I know a lot of people threw it at Uncharted a lot. When those games were coming out,
I think fairly at that.
I actually found out because I did play Uncharted 2, I forgot about this, but the main villain does mention to Nathan Drake that Nathan Drake has killed considerably more people than he has.
That's really funny. I did not know that. I guess that.
And I'll also say that it's not like they ever portray Nathan Drake as being adverse to killing somebody, which I think is what separates Nathan Drake from Lara Croft, and why I think it's a bit of a tonal dissonance thing to have her be like, oh no, I just killed someone, and then she's just getting racking up headshots, not only just like a couple minutes afterwards. All of the violence never gets to her. It's never a continuing downward spiral. She's just fine with it.
She's okay. All right. Okay. That's funny. Well, I think I've run out of stuff to talk about with exploration and ludonarrative dissonance and things like that. If you think there's any last minute thing, any anecdote, speak now.
I would just say, to wrap up the conversation on open world games, is just simply, if you make an open world and put a bunch of stuff I don't want to do in it, it's not an open world.
I think that is incredibly true. And maybe even slightly profound.
Like, if you want it to be open and have stuff for me to do in it, it needs to be worthwhile. I don't like checklisty open world where, like, as you have a checklist of collectibles and events to do and you're just marking them off. That's not fun. Like, that's not, you know.
That's not it.
You know, when you're playing Yakuza, you know, you're looking to what wacky thing Kiryu will run into the street next. You're going to these, you know, places to play mini games and stuff like that. You're not just like, oh, I have to complete however many Tsujimon battles or like fight 10 Novo rich guys. I mean, you're kind of doing that if you do the, you know, the completion checklist. But that's not how you're supposed to be playing the game.
Right. It really isn't. You're supposed to just have fun going through and seeing whatever random insane bullshit is coming up next. And I think that's the best way to go through it. I think that's where it's at. I think that's why that people enjoy the games so much. It's not to do the completionist shit. It's to have fun with whatever you find along the way.
I also think that good open world games shouldn't have things that are necessarily connected to the gameplay loop, because there's plenty of things in Yakuza that you can do that don't have any correlation with like a item reward or anything like that. They're just there for fun. You know, you can get through the whole Yakuza game without ever having to play Mahjong. It's not like, because like I feel like FF7 Rebirth falls into this problem a lot, where sometimes it'll force you to play a mini game that you don't aren't particularly fond of, or it'll do the thing that gets me, where it's like, well, you could get through this mini game by just doing rank 1, but if you get a rank 3 score, then you get another weapon for Yuffie, and then I'm like, ah, fuck, and then I gotta spend 25 minutes on this fucking mini game to get that weapon for Yuffie, because you held a gun to my face and was like, you want gameplay reward.
Damn. Well, that's what gets people to want to play it, though. That's what makes you want to do it. It gives you a good reward. But as Sergio and I have stated, the path itself must also be fun. And with that, I hope everybody else finds other things that they enjoy in life. Don't just do it for the end. The end does not always justify the means. Do things that make you happy. And don't die.
With that, we love you.
I don't.